Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Shares in Facebook took a nosedive this morning, dropping 19%. Because of an earnings report after the market closed yesterday that is troubling many investors. Here's the headline. The number of daily users of Facebook in the U.S. and Canada is no longer growing. Facebook is also now losing daily users in Europe. Callum Borchers is senior innovation reporter at WBUR. He joins us in the studio. Hi, Callum.
Glad to be with you.
And we should say that Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg described this as a solid quarter. Revenue is still up by more than 40% compared to this time last year. But what is happening? Is this all about the privacy issues and people dropping out of Facebook as a result?
That's part of it. You mentioned the number of users leveling off or even dipping in some areas. But I think part of what we're seeing actually may be the reverse, which is that investors could be worried that Facebook is so focused on addressing users' privacy concerns that the business is going to suffer as a result. I'm reminded of what Zuckerberg said during his Senate testimony back in April. He said, "I've directed our teams to invest so much in security that it will significantly impact our profitability going forward." And then on the earnings call yesterday, he said, we're beginning to see just that this quarter.
Well, and tell us about the earnings call, because Zuckerberg was pretty positive in that call, but then the chief financial officer, Dave Wehner, got on. What did he do that caused some alarm?
So Wehner said our total revenue growth will continue to decelerate in the second half of 2018. It's that continue word that I think really has investors alarmed. In other words, he was signaling this wasn't just a bad quarter and it's behind us now and we can move on. He was saying things are going to maybe get worse before they get better again.
And they lost a huge amount of money, a huge amount of market capitalization in the drop just today. Facebook, of course, is grappling with a number of controversies, how the platform was used for fake news in the 2016 election, how the firm Cambridge Analytica obtained data from users, and then now the company's policy not to remove offensive content. I want to listen to Mark Zuckerberg here speaking last week with Recode, defending that policy with an example.
Right. Okay. So I'm Jewish. Mm-hmm. And there's a set of people who deny that the Holocaust happened.
Yes,
right. I find that deeply offensive. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I don't believe that our platform should take that down, because I think that there are things that different people get wrong. Either I don't think that they're intentionally getting it wrong.
Now, he has since clarified that statement, but does the company need to do more now to stop the bleeding?
I think we'll probably get our answer between now and November 6th, which, of course, is the date of the midterm election. I think that if in that period we're seeing a lot of headlines about how Facebook continues to be a platform where Russia and other bad actors can spread disinformation, that's going to continue to damage Facebook's reputation. If, on the other hand, they get credit for seeming to clean up the platform and get rid of all that fake news, then perhaps they can begin to restore confidence of their users and investors.
We should say, just for context, that Facebook's profits are still up by more than 30% compared to last year, and today's drops have brought the value of the stock price basically where it was in May. They've lost all the gains that they've made in the last couple of months.
Yeah, this may just be sort of what they would call a market correction, right? Mm-hmm. It may be that investors were just too optimistic about the future of the company. I think the broader context, too, is that maybe people are losing a little bit of faith in these iconic tech CEOs. Throw Elon Musk in there with his Twitter antics lately.
That's WBUR's Callum Borchers. Thank you.
Glad to be with you.
Well, Callum and Jeremy, a longtime tech reporter, Walt Mossberg, called Zuckerberg's Holocaust remark cowardly. Mm-hmm. One Holocaust scholar tweeted, "This is breathtakingly irresponsible." And many users do want Facebook to do more to restrict and remove misinformation and hate posts, which makes Antonio Garcia Martinez a lone voice. He's a tech entrepreneur and columnist for Wired, also a former product manager for Facebook. And Antonio, you have been defending Mark Zuckerberg. Why?
Well, because to be blunt, the right to free speech is the right to offend, right? That's the only right to free speech that matters. And I think the general conception of what's called hate speech is much broader than the actual legal conception of it. And, you know, while Zuck's position might seem extreme in some sense, I mean, to be honest, that's the law of the land. In the United States, you can't actually, the government can't actually censor speech unless it's going to cause imminent unlawful action, to use the legal term. And Facebook's position is more or less that of the government.
Well, and as you say, there has to be an imminent sense of, you know, danger of harm to someone. What about the other thing that Zuckerberg is getting, or Zuck, as you call him, is getting criticized for, which is Alex Jones and his InfoWars site? I mean, he's the one who drove the narrative of the unbelievably untrue story that Hillary Clinton, then candidate, was running a child sex slave ring in the basement of a pizza parlor, and some guy picked up a gun and went there to liberate the children. That's causing harm.
Right. I mean, in that case, Facebook actually would pull down the post. I mean, Facebook, it's a little known fact, but Facebook actually does take a very active role in policing that.
Well, yeah. But they didn't after the Holocaust remark. Again, Alex Jones, radio host, did it again. He was talking about Robert Mueller, the, of course, who's running the Russia investigation. He called him a pedophile and pantomimed shooting him. Let's listen to a little of this.
The word is he doesn't have sex with the kids. He just controls it all. Can you imagine being a monster like that? God. God. Oh, people say, well, God, aren't you scared of him? I'm scared of not manning up. I look at that guy, and he's a sack. That's a demon I will take down or I'll die trying. So that's it. It's going to happen. We're going to walk out in the square politically, high noon, and he's going to find out when he makes a move, man. Make the move first, and then it's going to happen.
And this is when Alex Jones mimes shooting a finger pistol. Should that have been removed?
I mean, it sounds like it does actually veer on inciting imminent unlawful action. I mean, I'm obviously not a lawyer, but it does seem like it's actually brushing up against that line. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it was removed, but not by Facebook. So he might have taken it down himself. Look, there's the question of whether something is free speech, but also, isn't there kinds of speech? Broadcast entities, there's certain things we can't say. Broadcast outlets are required to monitor that. I know Facebook is a private company, but isn't it the same thing? Why shouldn't there be requirements?
Well, I think this gets back to the big real macro issue here, which is, is Facebook a media company? Does it actually have editorial responsibility in the same sense that, say, the New York Times or, NPR does? I think that's been a tough thing for them to grapple with. I mean, I was there several years ago, but I don't think their corporate culture has much changed. And they were very, very much a tech company. They didn't see themselves as a media company. They saw themselves at most as the plumbing that distributed media. Mm. And, as much as I liked my former employer and my former boss, Zuck, I don't know that we should appoint him to be global arbiter of truth, to be honest. If we appoint Facebook the arbiter of truth, how do we know that they're not injecting either a liberal or conservative bias?
Well, that's like saying that, NPR should only be concerned about the radio wavelengths.
Well, but NPR produces content. That's a difference. Facebook doesn't. Right?
Well, NPR produces content, but we also allow people to put their content on, as you are just now. You're speaking your views. Maybe Mark Zuckerberg should move in the direction of bringing in an editorial board. No?
When I get, for example, some telemarketing call or when I get some spam email, I don't blame, AT&T or I don't blame Google, because in some sense we've mentally parsed those as utilities. But, somehow whenever you see some, outrageous story or some crackpot theory like Alex Jones going off in some ridiculous terror, the Facebook logo is right next to it. And somehow we heap all the political angst that we have around misinformation, Trump, political polarization on this one company. Mm. And I can't help but feeling there's a little bit of a scapegoat mechanism going on. And so, in some sense, Mark Zuckerberg built this massive mirror to society, and when we don't like what we see in it, we kind of blame the mirror maker, right? Rather than the image that appears there that's frankly partially a function of us. But, there was a lot of admittedly maybe idealistic and naive visioneering about how what Facebook was going to be. And, this whole vision of Facebook being the newspaper to the world goes back years. I mean, that was the rallying cry when I joined in 2011. And it became reality way more than even I thought at the time.
Well, and you say it would be the newspaper to the world. But again, I can't think. I mean, there may be one or two newspapers out of the millions who would ever allow Alex Jones to be on the front page. So the difference lies there. But do you have concern that your thinking is going to last? Because you point out the stats that a minority of U.S. millennials think it's essential to live in a democracy. 40% support having the government limit speech that offends minorities. Mm-hmm. Whereas those who are older, 70% of adults born in the 1930s think democracy is essential. And only 12% of adults 70 or over think free speech should ever be abridged to avoid offense.
No, that's right. I mean, without question, mine is, strictly speaking, a minority view. What we're broadly calling millennials, and it's kind of a wide thing there. I mean, I'm on the cusp of it. Mm-hmm. Clearly have very different views around things like the centrality of democracy and free speech as an abstract principle that should be respected above, you know, more moral or more progressive concerns, right? I mean, Facebook is basically following what's called Brandenburg versus Ohio, which is a sort of governing case law around hate speech.
This is a Ku Klux Klan leader speech that was held up by the courts.
That's right. But I wonder, you know, courts and, you know, priests, anyone who interprets any sort of holy document is not quite perhaps as originalist and traditionalist as they think they are, and they kind of bend to the popular will at some point. And so, you know, asking how via what constitutional mechanism we're going to get there is kind of above my pay grade, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if 30, 40 years from now, indeed, my view and that of Zuck is considered a thing of the past.
That's Antonio Garcia Martinez of Wired. We'll link you to his writing at hereandnow.org. Antonio, thank you.
Thank you.
And so, should Facebook be doing more to ban hate and fake news? And we heard how they're losing users. Are you one who has exited? Your thoughts welcome, hereandnow.org.
President Trump is in the Midwest today trying to reassure farmers who are being hurt by his trade war. But it's not just farmers who are feeling the pain. A local newspaper in Colorado, the Daily Sentinel of Grand Junction, is cutting back on its print edition 2 days a week, in part because of the rising cost of newsprint. The Daily Sentinel's publisher, Jay Seaton, joins us now via Skype. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you're blaming this in large part on the increased cost of newsprint because of the tariffs?
I don't want to lay it all at the feet of the tariffs and the Trump administration, because paper prices have been going up and up over the last several years as paper mills consolidate and there's less of a market for newsprint. But the Trump tariffs did certainly spike that price, and so it drove a decision that may have been overdue anyway.
How much does that cost you with the tariffs on the newsprint?
It's about a 30% increase over what we have been paying, and most of that has occurred in anticipation of the tariffs and then directly as a result.
But how much of your budget has to go to just the paper to print it on?
It is our second largest expense in this building. It's a substantial portion of our budget behind human beings. So it's quite a blow. The amount or the percentage of newsprint cost depends on how big your circulation is. And our circulation is about 25,000. So that's a lot of newspaper. And so it's a substantial portion of our budget.
The other portion you say is human cost. So you're also blaming part of the reason that you have to take away these two print editions on higher minimum wage legislation.
Yeah, the state of Colorado passed minimum wage legislation, which I think, you know, it may be appropriate in some metro areas, but the way it affects rural areas like Grand Junction, Colorado, is quite disproportionate. I don't think that the minimum wage in Denver, Colorado, or in San Francisco, California, has anything to do with a minimum living wage in a place like Grand Junction.
You also mentioned increased healthcare costs.
We've experienced double-digit healthcare increases over the last several years. And so we're looking at another substantial increase in our renewal this year. And so it is a convergence of unwanted and unexpected expenses.
So with these changes that you're making, do you see a way to profitability for this newspaper?
Well, we have to. We will find a way to profitability because we serve a mission. It's not a profit mission. It's a First Amendment mission. So existence is not an option or a non-existence. So we will find a way to make this work. This change, going to digital delivery 2 days out of the week, is a substantial step in that direction. And, you know, we have a revenue problem in this industry, and we have to find a way to make it work, because we still drive an enormous audience We just don't have the revenues we had 10 years ago.
Why not just go all digital?
You know, this community is a newspaper community, and it skews a little bit older. And so going all digital is an enormous step that I think a lot of our readers aren't ready for. But this is a baby step, and who knows? Maybe we will be all digital in 10 years. But frankly, I think we're going to be printing a newspaper in 10, maybe even 20 years. I just want to be able to deliver news information to people in the medium in which they want to consume it.
Well, and I'm looking at your paper online right now. Just a couple of the stories that you're covering. Grizzly Act draws protesters at Mesa County Fair. BLM to sell leases in national forest land. Grand Junction Airport looking for input on standards of operation. Tell me about the importance of this paper to the community.
Grand Junction is 4 hours away from Denver and 4 hours away from Salt Lake. In many ways, it operates as an island community. It's pretty remote. Community of 150,000. And so the way people traditionally get their news information in this community is from the Daily Sentinel, which has been in existence 125 years. So it's deeply embedded in this community, has quite deep roots. And so we are the go-to for news information around here.
How have people reacted to this change?
That has been quite mixed. You know, we have a lot of people who say, you know, it's about time. You know, you guys have a 19th century business model. Perhaps you got to catch up to the 21st century. There are others who, particularly our older readers, are very upset about this change. And I've had dozens of telephone calls, and they say that they get it. But these are folks who don't own a computer, don't want a computer, and aren't willing to try a computer. And so they feel like something has been taken from them. And that's been hard for me personally, because that's the opposite of what we want to do.
How do you get your news?
I wake up early in the morning and I go on my iPad and I read the digital edition of the Daily Sentinel, which arrives in on my iPad about 4 a.m. And then I come into the office and I read a few national newspapers in print. And then on the weekends, when I have more time, I will sit down with the Daily Sentinel, the print edition, and spend some more time with it.
It's funny how it's become like that, where, you know, you do the digital version out of utility. It's just faster and easier, but it feels almost like taking a vacation to sit down with the print edition of a newspaper.
There's some truth to that, and it feels more real when it's in print. And I'm fully aware of that. Huh. There's a permanence to print that digital just can't replicate.
That's Jay Seaton, who is publisher of the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel in Grand Junction, Colorado. They are going to all digital for 2 days a week and will continue to do 5 print editions per week. Jay, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Robin, Grand Junction's Daily Sentinel isn't the only newspaper making cuts. The owner of the New York Daily News also announced this week that it is cutting staff to focus more on digital news. We're hearing that story a lot. Let's bring in NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's start with the Daily News. It's been aggressive in covering local news in New York City. It's won 11 Pulitzer Prizes, including one last year. But obviously, things have not been working financially. What is there logic behind what Trunk, the owner, is doing?
Here's the surface logic. The industry itself is, you know, across the country, as we've just heard, being hit in markets large and small by changes in how people consume news and where advertisers are fleeing to try to catch up with them through Google and Facebook in particular. That said, you know, if you look at the tabloid business in New York, the Daily News and the Post have bled money for years, and they've been propped up by the interest and vanity of their billionaire owners. Rupert Murdoch at the New York Post has a huge empire that helps them subsidize that. And Mort Zuckerman, the real estate magnate here in New York, used the New York Daily News, like Murdoch used the Post, to have a place at the table to talk, be able to talk politics, public policy, and have big issues. He sold it to Trunk last year. That's not what they do. And they've shown in market after market that they want to wring out big costs. And in this, in the nation's largest market, they've clearly wrung out the most. They're cutting what was already a shriveled staff in half, down to about 40 journalists.
Yeah, well, you know, it makes me think about even smaller papers. I've been thinking, David, about the tiny Woodstock Standard in Woodstock, Vermont. They had a terrible fire last week, burned their office to the ground. They still put a paper out, as they have for 165 years, with the help of the community. They have an 82-year-old owner, Philip Camp, who says, we're not, you know, closing. The Capital Gazette in Annapolis, the devastating shooting there. You have pictures of the staff working to put out the paper, and people again from the town coming, bringing sandwiches, rallying around them. These smaller papers mean something.
You know, Robin, I think you're right. I think they help to bind communities and give them a sense of identity, particularly in places that are outside major cities. But, you know, for Annapolis, a proud small state capital, a place that's home of the U.S. Naval Academy, a place known for seafaring folks in Chesapeake Bay and the like, the newspaper has been a central defining feature of the community there. And people have rallied around, as journalists have rallied, to donate their time and services to help do reporting and to help that staff keep putting out the paper.
We should note also that in many places where the local newspaper is the only place you can get news, the public radio station is also a very important source of local news in places that have lost other sources of local news. But David, are these local papers ever going to be able to have the business model that something like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post, these national papers have?
No, and I think one way you're able to see that is the degree to which all three of those titles have flourished as they've pulled back from doing local coverage. You know, Wall Street Journal you think of as mainly a financial paper, but after its acquisition a little more than a decade ago by Rupert Murdoch, it promised to really throw resources at covering the greater New York area and did so and has pulled back. The New York Times has pulled back greatly. It's much more interested in getting subscribers in Shanghai and Sao Paulo and St. Petersburg than it is in the outer boroughs of New York at this point. They think that there's more high-priced digital subscribers to be found at lower incremental cost through gathering up people who want to read stuff from all over the world.
Look, I want to ask you about CNN reporter Caitlin Collins. She was excluded from a press event yesterday. CNN says it was because she was told she asked inappropriate questions of the president as pool reporter representing all media when she asked the president questions about the tape of him and his lawyer, Michael Cohen. Last night on Fox News, Brett Baer read a statement of support from Fox for her. Let's listen.
As a member of the White House press pool, Fox stands firmly with CNN on this issue of access.
You know, people are saying, wow, but I remember during the Obama administration, there was an attempt to block Fox, and CNN and others opposed that. Your thoughts?
Well, and Brett Baer directly referred to that when he caught flack from some of Fox's most conservative fans and said, listen, Jake Tapper and CNN stood up for us. We on the news side need to do that. Jay Wallace, the president of Fox News, put out a similar statement to Brett Baer's. It was interesting to note that one of their lead anchors on Fox Business, Lou Dobbs, trashed Collins and CNN, saying, who the hell do you think you are? Mm. Right. And there's a bit of a split. Let's not forget the guy issuing the edict at the White House over this is Bill Shine, former co-president of Fox News.
All comes back to that. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet, guys.
For the first time, scientists say they have detected water in an underground lake on Mars. This raises the possibility of finding life on the red planet. Joining us now is Kelly Beatty, senior editor at Sky and Telescope. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Jeremy.
So how significant is this discovery and what do we know so far?
This is an area of Mars that's near its permanent polar cap, South Pole, and the water is at the base of a thick layer of ice on top of the planet. We have things like that on Earth, under glaciers, for example. So this was expected, but it took years of probing this polar cap with radar on board an orbiting spacecraft in order to get the right echo that gave them confidence. In terms of its significance, it is really significant because we know the water's there. We suspected it's been there for a long time, and now we have the proof.
And this was not NASA that found this. This was the Italian space agency.
Right, because the radar system is on a European spacecraft called Mars Express. It's been there for 15 years. NASA also has a spacecraft with a radar on it, but those scientists, the NASA scientists, interpreted these same echoes as a temperature issue, not as liquid water. So there was a little bit of a competition there to see who would come up with this first.
So what's the next step in terms of figuring out if there's life?
Oh, boy. So the problem is that the temperature, they suspect, is about 90 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. And it's very difficult to get water to stay liquid at that kind of temperature unless you load it up with a lot of different kinds of salts, antifreeze, if you will. And whether life could be, you know, happy in such an incredibly salty environment remains to be seen.
Maybe a little microbe. I mean, that's all they're looking
for,
really.
That's the best you could hope for. And there are sorts of microbes who can tolerate salt on the Earth, so maybe.
Speaking of Mars, this is actually a great time for people here on Earth to view the red planet. Mars is making its closest approach to the Earth since 2003. It's going to be brighter than all the planets except Venus. What's the best time to see it?
Well, Mars is reaching what's called opposition, which means it's opposite the sun in the sky. The sun sets on the other side of the horizon in the east. Mars will be rising. So I would try as early as, say, about 10 o'clock. The actual time when it's closest is 3:50 a.m. Eastern time on the 31st. And at that time, it will be about 35.8 million miles away, which sounds like a long distance. Right. But for Mars, it's really close. The planet itself will be brilliant and obvious. It'll be like a glowing ember in the sky.
I have noticed in recent days that you can see a number of planets right now that they look like these really bright stars. There are a lot of them in the sky at the moment.
That's right. If you start in the west after sunset, that brilliant star there is Venus, the brightest planet. Then moving to the left toward the east, you have Jupiter, Saturn, which is the dimmest of the lot, and then finally Mars. And they're in a big arc, which is following the zodiac in the sky, and that's why those planets are along there. It's a great time. We can see four bright ones all at once, and take it all in. It's eyeball astronomy. You don't need a telescope.
Just one more thing. The Perseid meteor shower coming up every August, but this year it's supposed to be especially good.
Especially good because there won't be any moon in the sky, and moonlight tends to wash out the fainter meteors. This will be a great time to just get out, find a dark spot with as little light pollution as possible, and take it all in.
When does that start?
That is peaking on the night of August 12th. So we have a couple of weeks to prepare for that. You can find all this stuff on our website, skyandtelescope.com.
It's Kelly Beatty, senior editor at Sky and Telescope. Thank you.
A pleasure.
If anyone ever exemplified that old saying, a parent's job is never done, it's Norma Brickey. The 82-year-old Columbus, Ohio resident has spent the last month driving her SUV around with a big sign in the window that reads, "My son needs a kidney, O positive," followed by her phone number. And boy, she had calls. She fields everyone herself, directing potential candidates to the transplant program at Ohio State University for follow-up testing, and then she follows up with them as well. According to the National Kidney Foundation, more than 121,000 people in the U.S. are on the kidney transplant waiting list. About 3,000 are added every month, and they say 13 people die every day waiting for a kidney. So Norma isn't sitting around. I heard about her when she first started, and I called her on a Saturday night. She wasn't able to come on the program then. She was just so busy, but she's got a little breathing room now. Norma, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Boy, I'm wondering how it's going on, because I don't know if you remember, but that Saturday night when we spoke, this had all just started, and you had had to go, you told me you had had to go out to buy a yellow legal pad to keep track of all the calls. I was thinking, oh, this poor woman, she's going to be overwhelmed. How's that legal pad doing? How's it going?
Well, I finally did get organized, and I still have a lot of callbacks to do.
Wow.
I've tried to reach them, but I don't get answers all the time, but I keep trying. Yeah. But I've had a lot of people that called, and I have probably about 20 people that are testing. Some of them have called me back. And they haven't tested it out, and I'm still searching. I'm still on my mission.
Wow. Okay, so I want to hear more about the mission and why, because this is a very personal family issue. It involves many people in the family. But so what do people say when they call you?
They just want to help. I'm just shocked at the people, their kindness, their concern, and you know, people say that young people, the new generation, but I'm finding a lot of the callers are like under 40.
Yeah, so you're saying people say the young people today aren't maybe as generous, but you're hearing they are? Is that?
Oh, so much so.
Yeah.
So much.
But do they understand? I mean, first of all, do they understand that it has to match? It has to be a match? And that.
Well.
Yeah.
This is where transplant comes in. This is where Ohio State comes in. They send them a packet that explains everything to them in a CD, and then they check their health because they are concerned about their safety, and then they have to pass a lot of testing.
And when you mentioned those organizations, this is the key.
The transplant people at Ohio State University.
Yeah, at Ohio State. So talk about your son. And then by way of that, yourself. This is something you're very familiar with.
Yeah, I have two sons. My other son received a kidney transplant, and I have received a kidney transplant about 11 years ago. A total stranger gave me a transplant. She was a dental technician from Washington State. She came to Columbus. Since then, she went back to medical school, and she's now a doctor.
This is a family disease. What's it called?
It's called polycystic kidney disease. Uh-huh. It's the cyst form on your kidneys. You don't even know you have it. I didn't know I had it until I was like 65. Mm-hmm. And you have to have an ultrasound to determine whether you have this or not. But it takes over your kidney function. And then you end up on dialysis out begging for a kidney like me.
Well, and you discovered the kindness of strangers, as you just explained, and so did one of your sons. Now another son is looking for that to happen for him. How is he?
Well, he goes to dialysis 4 hours, and then after that he goes to work 12 hours. He's a nurse. Dialysis is when they clean your blood because your kidneys cease to function. It's very frightening. The first time I went was so frightening to see my blood being taken out of my body, run through a machine and put back in. Mm. Mm. And it's a really unpleasant experience. And he's been on dialysis almost 2 years now.
Well, and I'm imagining that as this fierce mother that you are, that, you know, you would rather it was just you than him. I mean, to watch your son must be harder.
Yeah, and then it makes you feel bad to know that you've spread this disease to your kids and even my grandson, who's in his 20s.
Wow.
But my daughter didn't get it.
Well,
it's
one.
Real strange. It just hits certain members of the family.
Yeah. So he's been on this waiting list for 2 years. The waiting lists are so long.
Well, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And so
they are.
So when did you decide to pop a sign in your car and drive around?
I saw someone do this.
What?
I read about it. I saw it somewhere, and I thought, why not try it?
Actually, we talked about that night. I Googled around. There was a young woman who did it.
For her son, and she had hundreds of calls, and she went through the same thing I'm going through. It's the sifting through and the filtering through, getting that right match. But anyway, what I wanted to say about my son, he's been a friend of God's for many years, mm-hmm. and people like to know that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I do get calls from people. They want to know if this is real because it's probably shocking for people to see you ask for a kidney. Mm-hmm. But my son probably gets up every day and asks himself, is this real, that this has happened to him?
Yeah.
And I told him this is the year I'm going to find him a kidney.
Yeah. I don't know how else to put this. You sound fantastic.
It's my mission. This is my mission this year.
Well, but, you know, you're 82. And I'm sure you want to make use of every moment doing this.
Oh, yeah, that's what I do. I make calls every day. I try to reach all those people I didn't get to talk to.
Yeah. For people listening who may be unfamiliar with this, nobody can be paid for a kidney. That's illegal.
No.
So people, this is out of the goodness of their heart. It is a risky surgery for them, too. It, you know, most always goes well, but there's some risk for them.
Yes, they do have to realize that. And Ohio State will well inform them of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, they ask me, well, how does this work? Well, I just tell them my experience. That's all I know. But I'm sure there's a lot of other experiences.
And yours was a lovely one.
It was.
When you told your son you were going to do this, what did he say?
I love you, Mom. Anyway, Robin.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just want to thank all of the kind callers from Facebook and my sign. Mm. And Robin, I want to thank you and NPR.
Oh, well.
You've been so kind to me.
We really appreciate that. But you're the one, I'm sure, that, you know, people across the country are thanking, because you're not the only one. You're not the only mother desperately hoping that your loved one can get a kidney. So who knows? You might get some extras.
My other son said to me, "Mom, if this happens, why don't you help other people?" And I may do that.
Yeah.
My husband passed away 3 or 4 months ago, and I don't really have a lot to do anymore. And I know a lot of people that would love to have a kidney.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people at dialysis, where my son goes.
Well, you've become a one-woman billboard for that in your car. How long do you think you can drive around?
Oh, I'm a very good driver.
I didn't mean that. I meant, you know, how long can you... Well, as you've said, you don't feel that there's anything else more important.
No, I run around doing... I don't make extra trips for people to see the sign. I just do my errands. And almost every day I get a call. Yeah. I get like maybe 2 calls, 3 calls a week. Or I get a text of people, "I can't help you, but I'll do anything I can do to help you. I'll even put a sign on my car. I'll stand in front of businesses." I get all these offers for help.
Yeah.
And then they tell me that they're keeping it going on Facebook. And then they do, and then the calls die down for a while and someone else picks it up.
Well, listen, we want to stay in touch with you, Norma Bricky. We will post your phone number at hereandnow.org as it appears in the window of your car. And we wish you all the best. And I know you're very busy, but please keep us posted, okay?
Thank you, Robin.
Yeah.
Thank you.
President Trump is visiting Iowa and Illinois today, and he's talking about jobs and workforce development. He sparked criticism on Tuesday when he spoke to the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention in Kansas City. He was listing dignitaries in the audience, and he singled out one of them.
Along with your state's attorney general, hopefully, we need him so badly, hopefully your new senator-to-be, Josh Hawley. We need Josh badly. Josh, thank you.
Hawley is a Republican, one of 11 candidates in next month's Missouri Senate primary. Incumbent Claire McCaskill faces 6 challengers on the Democratic side. Joining us now is Paul Rykoff, founder and CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeremy. Good to be with you again.
And you tweeted a screenshot of the president and Josh Hawley on stage together, and you wrote, "This is what politicization of vets looks like." What was wrong with this?
Well, it really turned into a campaign rally. It was a nonpartisan veteran service organization national convention, which is something most presidents appear at. They know it's going to be a good photo op. They know it's going to look good on television, but they usually keep it nonpartisan. And they definitely don't get into electoral politics, like literally pulling a campaign candidate up on stage and going after candidates from one side or the other. So it's really uncharted territory.
Do you think that the VFW should have done something to stop this from happening?
It would have been in their interest. I think it would have been in all veterans' interest. But I think we're all guarded against politicians right now. We know that veterans are a very powerful political tool. We are the ultimate populist issue. Almost everybody in America, no matter what your political background is, supports veterans. And we're a nonpartisan organization. We've done events in the past with the president and others. And we know it's a very, very tricky situation. But I think everybody has to be guarded in times like these from being used by one side or the other to further a political agenda. So veterans are not a monolith. They're very politically diverse. There are over 20 million of them. But I think from the political standpoint, this is uncharted territory, and I think bad not just for veterans, but for our democracy.
And how uncharted is it? Because we of course, remember all presidents speaking in front of veterans, holding rallies in front of veterans.
Yeah, I've never seen a president, you know, really since 9/11, pull a candidate up on stage, right? That's where I think it got very, very different. And if somebody's running for office in a swing state like Missouri, the conditions are very different. So I think all veteran service organizations and all nonprofits are going to be really guarded over the next couple of months. And frankly, President Trump has done this before. He's weaponized a lot of different issues, and lately he's been weaponizing the veterans community for things that are very divisive. For example, the national anthem or the parade. These are things that are not overwhelmingly popular. VA reform, that's popular. You know, helping women veterans, that's popular and bipartisan. But these other divisive issues where often veterans are being injected into a conversation that may not really be about veterans but about something else is really new. And again, I think it's more than about veterans. This is about our democracy, and we need to be able to speak for ourselves. And anyone who tries to hijack that voice or co-opt that voice from either side, Republican or Democrat, is really, you know, wading into new territory that's bad for veterans and bad for democracy.
When you look at the favorability ratings, though, President Trump has around 44% favorable view from active duty service members. President Obama was lower than that, about 36%. Why do you think that is?
You know, the modern military, especially the officer corps, has tended to lean Republican over the last few years. We've seen an increased diversity, though. I think that now you see many more independents. There's always been a core of libertarians, and Democrats are growing as well. So I think what you're seeing is a much more diverse mix, because you've also got a younger generation of veterans. Our average member at IAVA is around 30. The average VFW member is probably in their late 60s. So we're 20% women. We're ethnically diverse, geographically diverse. So just like the rest of the population, I think the demographics are shifting. But traditionally, you know, Republicans have had a stronghold in the military, but especially as we go into an election year, we don't want any party to take our community for granted. They should work for our votes, they should talk to our issues, and they should really demonstrate they can reach across party lines in the same way our military does. You know, when we're in Iraq and Afghanistan, there's no Republican and Democrat. We're all together. And that's what we look for from our political leaders, and especially on issues that impact us directly.
Well, on that note, Robert Wilkie was confirmed as the new Secretary of Veterans Affairs just this week. Do veterans have faith that the problems that the VA has been dealing with are going to be fixed now with Robert Wilkie in charge?
No, not at all, quite bluntly. I think as a sign of the changing times, 9 folks in the Senate voted against Wilkie. He's the first nominee for VA secretary that's ever had anyone vote against him. So it's the first time it wasn't unanimous. And I think that cuts to the division that's emerging around veterans issues. For a while, we were kind of insulated. The division and the partisan happened everywhere except around VA. Now it's overflowed into our world, just like everybody else in Washington.
That's Paul Rykoff, who is founder and CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Paul, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And a VFW spokesman told us today that candidates often appear at the organization's conventions, and it was President Trump's decision to bring Josh Hawley to the stage. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.